Hey, it's me, Tim Ranzetta, co-founder of NextGen Personal Finance. Thank you for tuning in to this NGPF podcast. Today, you're going to hear from the founder and CEO of a company called Wayfinder. His name, Patrick Cook Deegan. I have been very fortunate to actually have met Patrick in the early days of Wayfinder, and I can only tell you how much fun it has been to see the impact his course has had on the conversation around social emotional learning. As Patrick likes to say, this is beyond social emotional learning, and his curriculum is focused on his K-12, and the solution is really to prepare students to live purposeful lives. So we're going to get deep into Patrick's entrepreneurial journey, how this business was hatched out of the Stanford D School, what some of the challenges were early on in evangelizing kind of a new sector, a new segment of curriculum, and where to place it, as well as all of the recent successes he has had in terms of growing the base of schools and teachers and students that are getting the opportunity to experience his curriculum. So without further ado, Patrick Cook Deegan. Today, I am really excited to have Patrick Cook Deegan with us. He's the CEO and founder of Wayfinder. So we're going to let him talk a lot about that company. Patrick's not only a guest on the podcast, but a friend. Patrick, I was trying to remember when we first shared salads over on University Avenue in Palo Alto. What do you remember from that conversation?
I remember you talked pretty fast, and that you were smart and you knew the space, and that I went back to that salad place many times because it actually had one of the best salads on University Avenue.
Yeah, I think that was Jennifer Carolyn, yeah. Who's a phenomenal ed tech investor. I think she had connected us.
Yeah, totally.
So before we talk about Wayfinder, let's talk about your entrepreneurial journey first. First job you ever had?
First job or first entrepreneurial thing? They're different.
You know, the younger, the better.
Well, true to spirit, when I was in fourth grade, I started my own lawn mowing service in my neighborhood. So I printed out like 150 orange flyers that said like Patrick's Lawn Mowing Service and put them in every mailbox in my neighborhood. I lived in this kind of 1950s old school neighborhood in Maryland. And then I basically just pushed my lawnmower all over the neighborhood. And I started doing that in fourth grade.
Okay, how soon before you hired your first employee to, you probably, if you put 150 out there, you probably had more work than one fourth grader could do.
No, I just sweat a lot. I used to do a lot of sports, so I would like jog while I did the lawn mowing to count it as a workout. So it was just me. I did that through all of high school, and I kind of evolved. But yeah, I basically did, you know, yard work for 10 years.
Wow. And those summers in Maryland are hot too. So that was tough work.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk a little bit. You went to Brown University. It looked like you were involved with a social entrepreneurship group there. I think you may have even been the founder. Talk a little bit about that experience.
Yeah. So we started this thing my senior year called the Social Innovation Initiative at Brown. And so I was an undergrad from 2003 to 2008. And this was kind of, I wouldn't say, you know, like Ashoka was created in the 80s, but social entrepreneurship in college was kind of having like a heyday back then. And so basically I just found there were a lot of students at Brown that were kind of starting cool entrepreneurial things, but you know, none of us knew what we're doing because we're 22 years old, but we could learn from each other. So we basically, I kind of just network throughout the school, and we found all these people starting different types of things, like a public health thing in Mali and a school in India and a solar panel thing in Florida. And so we kind of got together and started eating dinners together, and it turned into this initiative which got housed at the public service center. And then eventually it was cool because they started awarding fellowships to some of the seniors that were graduating so they could carry on that work after school, because you know, it's hard to leave school and have no income to do that.
Sure. And that group has grown in prominence. I mean, I've met a lot of folks who kind of went through that program and since you were there and kind of have gone out and started social, you know, have engaged in social entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I mean, we were the first class. So we had this cool event. And then the next year, I think, you know, Scott Warren from Generation Citizen, who some of you, the educators here might know. But basically some dude walked up after he pitched and said, you know, if you don't, I'll give you money to just keep doing this and not get a job, right? And now Generation Citizen serves tens of thousands of kids. So he was in the second year. So we kind of helped launch, you know, that was one thing I was proud of, is just being able to enable that.
So you had a lot of varied experiences coming up, Fulbright scholar, high school teacher. I'd love to learn about how your experience as a high school teacher has informed the work that you're doing today.
Yeah, so I would call myself an education or an experiential educator before I was a high school teacher. So I led mindfulness retreats for young people. I took young people to Thai Burma border. I started an organization that took low income students abroad for the first time. And then also did like design thinking projects. So I think I didn't use this language at the time, but I was always interested in like purpose provoking experiences for young people. And so the research basically shows that to have a purpose provoking experience, like you have to take someone out of their bubble, right? That's where a lot of it starts, is you take someone out of their day-to-day norm. So experiential education is a really powerful way to do that, right? So I would take young men backpacking for the first time in the Sierra Nevadas and, you know, just having actually the same conversation next to a really big tree versus in their living room kind of changes things. So I did that for like 10 years. And then I basically wanted to see if you could capture some of the magic and the transformation that happened in experiential education into the classroom. So I taught mostly in Oakland at some alternative schools, and then a big picture learning school, which some of you all might be familiar with, but has an innovative model that kind of has students get doing internships and out in the world, which I really liked. And so I taught the freshman and sophomore boys, like basically the principal was like, hey, they don't really listen to anyone. And if they listen to you, you can have a job. And if they don't, I'm going to fire you by Thanksgiving. So he basically put all the 9th and 10th grade boys with me, and I just started making up a curriculum that, you know, I think now it's called social emotional learning, but I think it's a mix of like big life questions, human development, career development, but adolescents are wired to think about what do I want to do with my life? And some places in school answer that question and some places don't, right? And so really the thing I want to do is, could you help develop a curriculum that helped young people think about how they want to navigate their life.
Was there an experience or a specific lesson or activity that you created with that curriculum that continues on this day? Like where the light bulb went off, where you said, there's something here.
Yeah. I mean, there's one, it's called Your Support Crew. And so really like if you look at humans that have a sense of purpose, or really any thriving humans, they would say they have people they lean on, right? For different types of support. So emotional support, practical support, financial support, all different types of support. And especially for, you know, I think men, but especially young men, there's like this like bravado thing of like, oh, I'm going to do it myself. I don't need anyone. And so, you know, what this lesson does is it goes through and it picks different types of people in your life and shows like what type of support they have. So we call it like your coach, like who's the one that coaches you, or your confidant, who do you share, you know, more meaningful things with, or your lifesaver, like who's always there to back you up. And so what we do in the exercises, we have students name all these different people that they lean on. And then we see, hey, where are some areas where you might need some support, and how do you develop that? Because like generally people don't just walk up to you and say like, oh, are you feeling like tired or need financial support? Like, let me help you, right? So like even the way that we met was through someone, because I was looking for people to support Wayfinder, right? So basically support is not a reactive thing, it's a proactive thing. And how do you teach that? and also getting rid of the stigma, especially for young men, that like needing support is like lame or uncool, right?
So yeah, I wondered exactly, let's dive into that point deeper. How do you overcome that? Because that is
such a— Well, I think number one is I would show my own support crew, right? So a lot of what Wayfinder does is that I think of it as like sitting in a circle with students as opposed to being in the front of the room with students. So for most of the lessons, I would actually fill out the lesson beforehand myself, and then I would show it to them, right? And so I'd be like, hey guys, like, I'm a dude, like, I've had a lot of things go wrong in my life, and here are the people that have supported me and how. And that goes a long way. And like, we've refined the lesson now, and now it shows Giannis, who won the NBA MVP championship. If you watch his video from, I think it's 3 or 4 years ago, his acceptance speech for 6 minutes is just thanking everyone. And so now when I do it with young guys, I'm like, well, if Giannis can thank people for 6 minutes, like, you probably have some people that helped you. And so that's like a good way of just showing that, you know, like, this happens with people too. And it happens with really successful people, right? And so the idea, and Julian Freeland Fisher wrote this cool book, and I don't know if anyone here knows her work, it's basically how you get a job is who you know, right? And so you have to build those relationships, and particularly for, you know, for wealthy or more affluent kids, they just know people through their parents and their social networks. But for the students I was teaching, like, those people aren't just showing up in their life. And so one of the cool things about MetWest is that they were actively doing internships. And so I was like, well, how are you using that to build a long-term relationship, not just check a box? Because that person might be able to get you a job 5 years from now. You don't know. But you can use that opportunity to build a relationship with them.
Yeah, I just remember as a teen being terrified about reaching out to adults. When we talk about kind of putting your support crew together, some of it's going to be your peers, but some of it's going to be older folks too. How do you kind of prep them for that engagement where, you know, as an adult now, you realize there's so many people who want to help, but yeah, as a teen, you're sitting there saying, why would they want to help me?
Well, I think part of the way we actually do it is there's a lot of really cool research, like in this other activity we do before that to kind of prep it, is we call it a jigsaw puzzle. And we actually pass out 10 different pieces of research about how people are more likely to help than they think. And so they actually put the piece together. And almost all research shows that, like, people are more inclined to say yes to helping or volunteering or supporting one than they think. So first we go through the research of that. And then the support crew, their take home homework is to actually do one of two things. One is to just tell someone in their life that they play this role, which actually deepens it. And two is to proactively seek out a new role. And then we would coach them through that. So we would visit the support crew in like September, October, and then in April and May. And then you could see how it changed. And then one of the other cool things is we can talk about how many of those were relationships that kind of came to you and how many were ones that you kind of went and developed, and talking about how you want a healthy mix of those two things.
Awesome. So you had this experience at an alternative school in Oakland, and then you go to the D school. Maybe talk a little bit about what the D school is, the approach that they utilize, and how that helped you get Wayfinder off the ground.
Yeah. So basically, so the D school houses a thing called the K-12 Innovation Lab, which is basically taking the principles of design thinking and applying them to the K-12 field. And it was started by Dr. Susie Wise, who's a really cool longtime educator. And so basically she liked picking people, and they had this fellowship where you kind of had an idea. I the way I describe it is like you had all the ingredients to a meal and you knew what you wanted it to taste like, but you didn't know what the meal was. And so basically they paired me with a full-time curriculum designer, like a visual print designer. And they take your idea and they walk you through the design thinking process for a year to try and develop the curriculum. So I kind of walked in with this idea of, could you create a purpose-based curriculum for high school students? And I had the support crew and this activity and that activity, but it wasn't like a meal. And then through the year, we did a lot of work to like try and make it a meal. And so I would say actually one of the most useful things that I was super skeptical on, but really was powerful, was the empathy part where you're interviewing students and teachers. And I think often when you do something for a while, you just think you know what's up. So you're like, nah, I don't need to do that. But some of the most, I interviewed like 30 teachers and kids about it, sometimes for like 3 hours. And then we would make all these boards about it. And that, I just gained so many insights from that, right? So generally, you know, it's, I've rarely had a conversation with a teenager where you ask them something, they didn't have an opinion about it. But sometimes we forget to ask them when we're designing things for them. And so I think just the force function of having to ask them questions over and over. And so that has kind of fused our curriculum. So we just made, now we're full K-12 and we just developed like a K-6 curriculum this year. And like that involved, I think, 300 interviews with our whole team. So we had a whole team interviewing third graders and second graders and first graders. And that's partly where our curriculum comes from, which my hunch is most curricula for elementary school kids don't interview elementary school kids about what they need, but they generally know. You know, you have to use some wisdom and fill in the gaps, but I think that was a really useful part.
Okay, what was the most interesting feedback you got from somebody in that elementary school crew?
Basically they were like, yeah, we're down to do this, just make it fun. They're like, stop showing me puppets and like make it a game. So like a lot of our curriculum is really a lot of games. And I think one thing we tend to do is like undervalue or basically not meet kids where they're at enough, so treat them a little younger than they are, especially when it comes to SEL. So like, you know, I think a lot of the reason it doesn't resonate often with older kids is because we treat them like they're younger kids. So I think just making sure that like, you're not creating it for like the lowest bar, you're creating it for the highest bar, and then having students move up to that.
So you come out of the D school with this curriculum ready to go. And to some extent, you're creating a new market, right? Like there isn't, kind of in effect, and so I wondered kind of, how you figured out, you know, product market fit is something that entrepreneurs talk a lot about. Do you have a product that meets the market? You're in effect creating a market that may not exist because you're having to evangelize that this is something that should be part of, you started with high school, part of a high school curriculum. Talk about the early years.
Yeah. So we spent 2 years at the D school, doing kind of R&D and testing. And then we launched in 2017 with 1 year of paper-based high school purpose curriculum. And at the time there was like kind of a mini movement around like purpose-based education. So 5 or 6 or 7 organizations sprung up actually in the same 24 months, all around this theme of purpose for adolescents, but kind of unbeknownst to each other, we later kind of found each other. So, which is how kind of movements form. So we were all new, we were kind of doing it in different ways. But yeah, when I was pitching to schools, I was like, oh, we're a purpose-based high school curriculum model. And then most of it was, they're like, what's that? Like, what is that? And then, so I would spend half of my pitches explaining what we were doing and then why it was important. And this is also before COVID. And then, you know, we did get some schools, we've doubled each year, but we were getting like early innovators and people that were willing to take a leap or people that were already kind of on board with that and looking, which isn't a big percent of the school market, right? So, So we did that for a few years. And like, Tim, you and I had conversations, like my first sales guy that I hired, he taught at Harvard and BC. He had a PhD in purpose development, right? So we had to explain the purpose field while we were selling the curriculum. So I called that a double sell, which was, as you can imagine, challenging. So we did that for a while, and then a lot of things changed as we grew. And then when COVID happened, it kind of changed everything.
Where did you find, what were the use cases, at least at the high school level, maybe initially, and then where? So some of the educators on, you know, maybe personal finance teachers, economics, family and consumer science, and wondering, you know, is there a way for me to embed? But I also know that you worked with advisory and kind of where your curriculum fit
in. So we started in high school and then we added a middle school curriculum on belonging. So it went from 1 year to 2 years to 6 years, and now it's full K-12. And we started, our early use cases were mostly charters, after schools, kind of innovative, comprehensive schools, like someone willing to take a leap on some independent schools. And when I designed it, I thought it would mostly be used in advisory, but quickly it kind of spread throughout schools. So sometimes it went, you know, most high schools have like freshmen learn how to be a human in high school class, or senior get ready for life class. Sometimes it went there. Sometimes it got integrated into English class. Sometimes now it's gotten integrated. Our 12th grade curriculum right now specifically focuses on career development. So it's gotten integrated into a lot of those classes, design thinking classes. So I would say now, you know, I think this year we'll be at over 500 schools, and probably advisory will be less than a third of it. And so in terms of use case, so it's spread all over as we've expanded. And then I think what we'll talk about a little bit later is one of the things we realized is we kind of had what I call like the entree version of the curriculum. So it was like scope and sequence, 26 lessons once a school, like one, you know, over a year. And then we were finding that a lot of people, probably like a lot of the folks on here, they don't have time for that, or they don't want a full entree, but they want like an appetizer version. So we created this thing called the Activity Library, which has been really popular, which is like 2 to 25 minute activities that are career development, a fun game, an energizer, a cool connecting thing. And it's less sequenced, and it's more just, it's like grab and go. Like the way I imagine it is when I was, it's like having a hat where you can just, you know, pull out a ticket and be like, oh, this is a fun game for 10 minutes. So that's actually what we've used to scale pretty massively now. So when we start with a lot of districts, we start with that. And I call that like the appetizer version. And particularly in high school, you know, our biggest competitor is time, right? And the master schedule. And so this allows us to be able to work within that. And the other thing that's cool about the activity library is you can use it in other, you don't need advisory or SEL or this block, you can integrate it into any class, which is what has started to happen. But that was a big challenge, which is time.
You talk about this pivot into, because you didn't start out with career development in mind. And I think you noticed this link between the importance of social emotional skills in the career element, right? And you recently did a white paper about this linkage also. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I would say formally we were much more in like SEL human development bucket, and then we've moved more towards career development. But, you know, by definition, purpose means something that's meaningful to the self and consequential and pro-social to the world, right? So that's like Dr. Bill Damon's definition, who's at Stanford, who we base a lot of work on. So that's like a nerdy way of saying to have purpose, you have to care about it and it has to make a good impact on the world. So I would argue that we've always had an eye towards impact, but it's an internal and external. But the external was less skills-based. And how we've developed over the years, like we just edited our 12th grade curriculum, and it now includes like a whole module on entrepreneurship. And we have like a 3-part Shark Tank series where the kids have to pitch a product and then they come up with it. And then we talk about it, because like when you and I met, like I was pitching you, right? That's how the world works, right? And so if you're an entrepreneur, like I don't know, I probably pitched 1,000 people in my life and got told no 950 times, right? So how do you actually do that, right? Because last time I checked, like I've never submitted a business plan to anyone and I've started 6 things, like no one cares, right? So how do you prepare students to do that? So our curriculum has evolved to have more skills focused on career development. And then I think really what COVID illuminated, which I think we already knew, is that like the future is the only thing we know about the future is it's going to change rapidly and it's uncertain. And there's no way that schools can actually prepare students for the world they're going into because it's changing so fast on the technical side. And the key thing you have to do is prepare them to be like entrepreneurs and change makers in an evolving world. And I think that's where like durable skills or some of the 21st century skills we talk about, you're kind of giving them like, we call it a personal navigation system to navigate uncertainty, as opposed to like, you know, here's your bricklaying materials, go have a job for 50 years. That doesn't exist anymore. And so we're really trying to prepare students for the future, which I think is a mix of who are you and what do you care about, and what skills do you need to thrive in the 21st century.
You're listening to a podcast from NextGen Personal Finance. Does your local school district meet the gold standard, a standalone personal finance course for every student before high school graduation? Find out using our nationwide map under the Advocacy tab at www.ngpf.org.
How did you model that when the pandemic hit with your own organization?
Well, I didn't sleep much. I've done a lot of hard, it's the hardest thing I've ever done, right? So, we had to go digital. We were launching a new curriculum. I thought most of our schools wouldn't return. I was running out of money. I had to raise a few million bucks in the worst fundraising environment ever. You know, I was calling all my friends that worked at these schools and basically like, hey, if you don't return, we don't have a company, right? And so, it was hard. I was living on the road. You know, I almost went bankrupt. So it was super challenging.
What kept you going?
Well, I mean, I think I just, one, I hate losing more than anything. Like I can remember every time I've lost since I was in eighth grade. So that. And two, I just felt responsible for our customers, especially to my staff. I think once you employ people, you know, they bet on you. So, and like, I thought it was needed, right? I think actually COVID illuminated what we were doing more than ever. And actually it has. So I just don't, plus quitting's boring, you know? So like, I don't like quitting.
Quitting is boring. I'm going to put that one up on a bulletin board somewhere.
It's not like an interesting end to a story. Like entrepreneur closes thing because life got hard. You know, it's not like a good book at Barnes & Noble.
And then surprisingly, maybe not so surprisingly, I mean, the hockey stick happened, right? In terms of growth.
Yeah.
What, and you alluded to this earlier, but I'd love for you to dive in deeper. You know, why do you think your product offering suddenly became something every school felt like they, over 500 schools felt like they needed to buy?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know, you know, as much about your field, but your field's growing, right? What your educators do here. Which is like, I was thinking about what you guys do. And I just remember being in algebra and being like, I don't think I'm ever going to use this. And then I would talk to adults and then they'd be like, you ever use algebra? And I never found an adult that used algebra. And then like 4 years ago, I was like sitting there running a business. And I was like, man, if I could have one skill, it would be like knowing how Microsoft Excel works. You know, and I'm still like calling my uncle to be like, how do you get a mortgage? What's like, I'm almost 40 and I just figured out what a mortgage was, you know, like that would be kind of useful. So, and I think it like picks up steam where like that was obvious before. And sometimes people realize it and it gains. So in my field, like the mental health statistics for adolescents before COVID were terrible. Right. And I spent a lot of my calls on sales calls and they're like, yeah, but SEL is like a K-5 thing or a K-6 thing. Like we don't have time for it. And I'm like, well, a third of your kids are depressed and anxious and 5% are suicidal. So maybe you should pay attention. And they'd be like, yeah, we probably should, but like we can't change our schedule. So that was like a typical conversation that I had. And then when I got on the phone with after COVID, that whole first half of the conversation dropped away. So I wasn't justifying the need for it, particularly with high school kids. So, and you know, you read the Surgeon General's report that the ages hit the hardest mental health wise of everyone in the US was 11 to 18 year olds, right? They're suffering the most. And so I think the need and the clearness of the need trumped the kind of intransigence of dealing with the systems that made it hard. That's kind of what I would say.
So I'm guessing the next question when you're selling, because you're selling at the enterprise level to districts is, you know, how do we know it works? And I wondered kind of for those, you've been in schools now, you know, some schools probably 4, 5, 6 years. I wonder, you know, what are the measurements they're looking at to say, this is something that's that's impacting students in the way that we would hope?
Yeah, so we work with Bill Damon's center. There's a woman named Heather Malin, who's, they're kind of like the, I call him like the godfather of adolescent purpose development research, although probably no one else calls him that. But basically they've developed purpose-based measures for high schoolers and adapted them. So like we just had a study done at a school in the Bay Area and they measure six measures. So purposefulness, social awareness, agency, and all six of those measures went up at the school. And we actually have like four more studies coming out now. So we basically have taken the because you know our high school curriculum is really focused on the sense of purpose. So we've adapted adult measures of purpose down to high school students. Then we measure those six measures. And I think that study is available on our website now. And we should have more soon coming out. So that's one way we measure it. And then the other cool thing we just added this year is there's a tool called Waypoints, which is built into our curriculum, which is basically a formative assessment. It's like six questions based around skills and well-being. And so we ask students, you know, how are you doing? And are you learning the things that Wayfinder is trying to teach you? And so for this year, we're beefing it up. So that way students and teachers and deans and principals will be able to track in real time, how are my kids doing and are they learning things and is it increasing? So I think there's both the research side and then the you know, formative assessment built into the curriculum side.
Yeah, and I always think we can't forget about the anecdotal. Tell me about a classroom you visited at some point where you had kind of one of those wow moments of like, just saying, this was an idea I conceived 7 years ago and seeing it in action, being taught by a passionate educator and seeing the impact it's having on kids.
Yeah, I mean, one story that comes to mind, so I lived in Turkey for a few years, like in my 20s, and one of my Turkish friends moved to the US and he started a private school for all first generation refugees from different war-torn countries in the Middle East. So this was an all-girls school in Paterson, New Jersey. And he taught our purpose curriculum, our 12th grade curriculum, to all of these young women who, most of them have been in the US less than 3 years. All of them had fled from violence, like all hard lives, right? And there was one young woman named Summer who had fled the Syrian civil war, lived in the US. She'd been at that school since she was a freshman and she was a senior. You know, she felt scared. She felt like she didn't have much to offer to other people in the US because she's from a different culture. She's from a different country. And then our curriculum, we have this piece called The Purpose Compass, which is basically designing your own meaningful and purposeful project. And the way we define that is that it's a need in the world. It's a skill or strength you have, and it's something you love to do. And so she put this project together where she thought, okay, well, maybe I do have something to teach. And she started mentoring the other freshman girls at the school. And basically there's a thing called post-traumatic growth, where basically you go through a traumatic event. And then one of the ways you grow from it is by realizing what you have to teach from it. And so she actually became a mentor to a lot of the young women who had similar backgrounds. And it kind of changed the trajectory of her life, because instead of thinking, I don't have anything to offer, I've been through this really hard thing, I can't relate, she was like, okay, I actually do have something to offer, I'm going to offer it. And then it kind of helped her step into like her own power. And I've stayed in touch with her because my friend started the school. And she spoke about a bunch of events we had in New York. And it kind of just changed a sense of her own sense of agency.
Wow, that is awesome. I know educators are always looking for new ideas around activities. What's available on your website for them to pull from? And maybe two or three, if we can kind of go in a little bit deeper on, you mentioned a couple activities already, but just others that you might think are appropriate for high school.
Yeah, so I think we're going to make some, like one, there's definitely a follow-up thing I can send with some free activities. And I think, so basically what that is it's a tool that has 100 activities per grade band, so K through 12, and they're designed to be 2 through 30 minutes. They very little prep, and they go into categories like games, connection games, like fun, get to know you, and they're all meant to be done. The students don't need anything. You can prep, and most of them are like a minute tops. So I'll work with Tim to make sure you guys get that. But to give you an example of one, one is called, that I used to do with my kids, is called High School Reunion. And this is designed obviously for high schoolers, usually juniors and seniors. And so the idea is you spread the room out, and then you have students, so you pretend to put them like it's their 20th high school reunion. And so you turn on some music and like you like kind of get them into character and you're like, okay, you're now 38, you're coming back and you're going to share three different things. One is the really safe path you think now, like what's your safe path in life? And then you're going to share like, what would be like a really cool thing you did that you like think you might be able to do it, but you're not sure of. And then the third one is like, what would you do if you just blew it out of the water? Like something you can't even imagine. Right. And so you turn on music and you have them mingle around and then you're like, okay, do the safe option. Okay. Do the reach option. And okay, do the blow it out of the water option. And then you'll do it a bunch of times. And then like you can do themes on it and it gets pretty hilarious. And then when you pause, like the reflection back is like, okay, like the thing, your reach or your thing you can't imagine, like what's holding you back from thinking that's possible? Right? Why is that not possible? And one of the key things, if you look at basically a sense of purpose, you have to have a vision for something and you have to be able to imagine it, right? So there's a lot of research around being able to imagine your own future, right? Like if you think of Giannis again as an example, like that dude thought when he was like living on the streets in Greece that he could be in the NBA, right? And if he didn't think that, it wouldn't have propelled him to work that hard. So what we do is then we talk to students about like the power of visualization and it's called limiting beliefs. And then we talk and that leads into these other activities around like, well, okay, if you want to go for the cool thing or the really cool thing, let's change how you perceive your own future, right? And for a lot of my students, that was a really powerful, it's like a really fun way, I think, to get to a meaningful point, right? Because if you just sat down with a piece of paper and like, hey, write down things you think you can't do, then let's sit in a circle and tell me why. They're like, this sucks, you know? So that's an example of like one activity. So that takes like, you know, you can do it for 10 minutes to 20 minutes and probably takes 3 minutes of prep and like pretty self-explanatory.
Give us another one.
So I mean, another one just to go into, one is a really simple one that I loved with my ninth graders in particular, which is called, passion swap. And so basically, right. And in a lot of these classes, I'm imagining students don't know each other that well, right? Most comprehensive schools, they don't know it super well. So passion swap is basically you tell kids like, okay, it's Tuesday, on Thursday, you're going to come in and you're going to share like two things you're passionate about. And if you need any, like if you need anything for it, bring it. If you need your phone, if you need a camera, if you need your baseball bat, whatever it is. And then so you have students line up and sometimes they don't need anything, or like one kid brought their drumsticks, whatever it is, just some artifact if you have one. And then when you bring them in on Thursday, let's say you have like 30 minutes, you turn on some music, you have them stand in a circle. And then you intentionally have them mingle with the kids they don't know as well. And you say, okay, you guys have 5 minutes to share your passion. You get 2.5 minutes each. Like, what are you passionate about? Why? And how did that passion start? How were you exposed to it? And then so they each do that. And then they'll switch a few different times. And then you end the class by someone each sharing out someone else's passion that they didn't know as well before the class started. And so one thing that helps is that there's a lot of research that if you meet someone and you find out what they care about, you actually learn to get to know them in a cooler way. And then part two is that then we talk about how passions lead to purpose. And usually that sense of intrinsic motivation or being excited about something is key to having a sense of purpose, but it starts in small ways. So again, it's like a small thing where you're like, okay, like that's the feeling you want when you're doing, like, you'll know you have that feeling is good because it like, it gets that juice going, right? So that's like another one that I did with my freshmen a lot and it was really fun. So I think that the thing that we try and do is like, how do you make it fun and meaningful at the same time? I think, which is, I think is a design challenge for cool high school stuff.
All right, give us one more.
Well, I just read our whole high school curriculum in the last week. So I'm trying to think of, I'll give you one from like our core curriculum that I thought was really helpful. So one, it's actually, so one of them is on, basically we do a lot on habits. So especially if you notice, right, and probably some of the work you do is like a lot of financial like work as a human comes down to having healthy habits, right? And the same with being a person. So a lot of what we're talking about, especially in our 10th grade curriculum, is healthy habits. So we have this whole module called Blocks and Assists, where a lot of our stuff is themed off of sports a little bit. So we talk about unhealthy habits are blocks and healthy habits are assists. And that when we have blocks, like we make ourselves harder, and when it's assists, it gets easier. So we have one activity that's called trash can basketball. And basically what you do is you have students, like you just start with a brainstorm and you say, all right, what are like the five or 10 best habits you have? And everyone writes them down, like go to bed early, study, blah, blah, blah. What are bad habits you have? Like wake up and look at social media, always be late to school, et cetera. And then you go through and you say, which five habits do I do the most? Which five habits do I do the least? And then you have people play basketball against each other. And if they do that habit, a good habit, they get to get closer to the basketball to take their basket. And if they have a bad habit, they have to take it further away. And then you divide the team in two, and then whoever has the most points and gets it in the basket wins the game. And then they end up talking about their habits and what they could do to change. And then you'll actually play the game again after a whole kind of 6 weeks of changing your habits, and then see who gets the most points again, right? So the idea is to kind of gamify something. So you're talking about habits, but not in like a kind of boring way. And then you give them a chance to change their habits over 6 weeks, and you let them play again. And this was a very popular game we developed.
I know a lot of people, including myself, are wondering, how do you get them to change their habits? Because we'd all like to know how to change some of our habits too.
Yeah, well, one of the things I think we do is we include most of our, like in that module, for example, a lot of it shows the neuroscience to students, which I think is really cool. I think what I've found over and over is that the more you teach teenagers about how their brains work and how brains work generally, I think they respond to it really well. So in this instance, we actually just have them pick one habit, not a bunch of them. And so we have a thing, and we use a lot of research about it. So one of the ways that there's a thing called habit stacking. I don't know if people have heard of this, but you basically, if you have one good habit, you add another one to it. And so we really focus on habit stacking. So name something you already do well, and then what's an opportunity to add something to that. So that's like a way that we do that. And then in terms of getting rid of a bad habit, we actually have them do that kind of in a group, in a small group, because how you change a lot of bad habits are by being accountable, right? And it's really hard to do that alone. So we'll have, like, we had students be like, okay, I'm only going to use social media half as much for the next month. And then they would check in that small group when they started the lesson for those 6 weeks and be like, are you doing that? What's helping? What's not helping? Because a lot of research shows that it's really challenging to change a bad habit without peer support. But it's actually easier to start a good habit on your own.
My last question is, where do you come up with all these creative ideas?
Well, I mean, that's like the secret sauce. So, I mean, we have a team of 12 people, and we've probably put 40 years into it. Like this year I had 12 curriculum designers, right? And so, at this point we have, I think 1,000 people apply for each open position we have. So we've gotten to pick some pretty cool, and yeah, I mean, I think the two hardest things for us to work is having cool content and then getting schools to buy anything is probably the two You know, those are the two gauntlets. But I think one of the things that we do that's worked really well is when we make curriculum, we pair a longtime classroom teacher with a longtime experiential educator. And I think that works really well because the teacher understands the like confines of the classroom and the minutes and the directions you need. But an experiential educator has a lot, has a different approach, right? Because they're out in the woods and, or they're in Thailand. And so I think the combination of those two has been a little bit of our secret sauce, because if you go all experiential educator and then you show it to a teacher, they're like, what's happening? Like, I'm not next to a redwood. Like, what are you talking about? Right. But if you have all teachers, sometimes like they've been in a classroom for a really long time, and there's something about bringing in that educational experience that's really popular. So I think that's been what I've realized, that like how we design and develop our curriculum is we always have, if it's a team of four, we have two and two. If it's a team of two, we have one and one, right? So a lot of those activities, honestly, were developed when me and my best friend were leading wilderness rites of passage trips, and we just got really bored in the woods because the kids would be like, I want something else to do. And if you're a classroom teacher, you're not really, you know, you're not sitting around with kids endlessly being like, I have time to like just make random stuff up, you know? But we would have kids like sitting on some log, and we'd be like, you think we could play a fun game instead? And that's where the trash can basketball came up with. But we played it in the redwoods and in the Yosemite. So I think a lot of it comes from that.
All right, Patrick, I want to thank you for giving us a lot to think about, a lot of ideas. I know teachers were jotting down a lot of notes about some ideas of activities I'm sure they're going to want to bring back to their students. A few final housekeeping items before we go. We'll put links to all of the resources that Patrick mentioned. That'll be in the show notes, which you can find on our website, www.ngpf.org/podcasts. Better yet, subscribe iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave a review too. We're so fortunate to have such amazing guests, and I'd love for their message to resound even further. So please go ahead, take a minute if you enjoy the NGPF podcast and do that. I want to thank Ren McKino also. He is the brains and the brawn behind our podcast, both producing them as well as the show notes. Thank you, Ren. He always does it on short notice also. So on behalf of Patrick and myself, I want to thank you again for tuning in to this NGPF podcast. Have a wonderful week.